This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania by Eric Larson, read for you by Scott Brick. Mining Suspense, A Note to Readers. I first started reading about the Lusitania on a whim, following my between-book strategy of reading voraciously and promiscuously. What I learned both charmed and horrified me. I thought I knew everything there was to know about the incident, but as so often happens when I do deep research on a subject, I quickly realized how wrong I was. Above all, I discovered that buried in the muddled details of the affair, deliberately muddled in certain aspects, was something simple and satisfying, a very good story. I hasten to add, as always, that this is a work of non-fiction. Anything between quotation marks comes from a memoir, letter, telegram, or other historical document. My goal was to try to marshal the many nodes of real-life suspense and, yes, romance that marked the Lusitania episode in a manner that would allow readers to experience it, as did people who lived through it at the time. Although squeamish readers may wish to skip the details of a certain autopsy that appears late in the narrative. In any event, I give you now the saga of the Lusitania, and the myriad forces, large and achingly small, that converged one lovely day in May 1915 to produce a tragedy of monumental scale, whose true character and import have long been obscured in the mists of history. Eric Larson, Seattle. A word about time. To avoid confusing myself and readers, I've converted German submarine time to Greenwich Mean Time. Thus, an entry in Kapitänleutnant Walter Schwieger's war log for 3 p.m. becomes 2 p.m. instead. As for Britain's Admiralty, it is important always to keep in mind that the Admiralty's top official was the First Lord, who served as a kind of chief executive officer. His second in command was First Sea Lord, essentially the chief operating officer, in charge of day-to-day naval operations. The captains are to remember that whilst they are expected to use every diligence to secure a speedy voyage, they must run no risk which by any possibility might result in accident to their ships. They will ever bear in mind that the safety of the lives and property entrusted to their care is the ruling principle which should govern them in the navigation of their ships, and no supposed gain in expedition or saving of time on the voyage is to be purchased at the risk of accident. Rules to be observed in the company's service. The Cunard Steamship Company Limited, March 1913. The first consideration is the safety of the U-boat. Admiral Reinhard Scheer, Germany's High Sea Fleet in the World War, 1919. A word from the captain. On the night of May 6, 1915, as his ship approached the coast of Ireland, Captain William Thomas Turner left the bridge and made his way to the first-class lounge, where passengers were taking part in a concert and talent show, a customary feature of Cunard crossings. The room was large and warm, paneled in mahogany and carpeted in green and yellow, with 2 14-foot-tall fireplaces in the front and rear walls. Ordinarily, Turner avoided events of this kind aboard ship because he disliked the social obligations of captaincy. But tonight was no ordinary night, and he had news to convey. There was already a good deal of tension in the room, despite the singing and piano playing and clumsy magic tricks, and this became more pronounced when Turner stepped forward at intermission. His presence had the perverse effect of affirming everything the passengers had been fearing since their departure from New York, in the way that a priest's arrival tends to undermine the cheery smile of a nurse. It was Turner's intention, however, to provide reassurance. His looks helped. With the physique of a bank safe, He was the embodiment of quiet strength. He had blue eyes and a kind and gentle smile, and his graying hair, he was 58 years old, conveyed wisdom and experience, as did the mere fact of his being a Cunard captain. In accord with Cunard's practice of rotating captains from ship to ship, this was his third stint as the Lusitania's master, his first in wartime. Turner now told his audience that the next day, Friday, May 7th, the ship would enter waters off the southern coast of Ireland that were part of a zone of war designated by Germany. This, in itself, was anything but news. On the morning of the ship's departure from New York, a notice had appeared on the shipping pages of New York's newspapers. Placed by the German embassy in Washington, it reminded readers of the existence of the war zone and cautioned that vessels flying the flag of Great Britain or of any of her allies are liable to destruction, and that travelers sailing on such ships do so at their own risk. Though the warning did not name a particular vessel, it was widely interpreted as being aimed at Turner's ship, the Lusitania, and indeed in at least one prominent newspaper, the New York World, it was positioned adjacent to Cunard's own advertisement for the ship. Ever since, about all the passengers had been doing was thinking, dreaming, sleeping, and eating submarines, according to Oliver Bernard, a theater set designer traveling in first class. Turner now revealed to the audience that earlier in the evening the ship had received a warning by wireless of fresh submarine activity off the Irish coast. He assured the audience there was no need for alarm. Coming from another man, this might have sounded like a baseless palliative, but Turner believed it. He was skeptical of the threat posed by German submarines, especially when it came to his ship, one of the great transatlantic Greyhounds, so named for the speeds they could achieve. His superiors at Cunard shared his skepticism. The company's New York manager issued an official response to the German warning. "The truth is that the Lusitania is the safest boat on the sea. She is too fast for any submarine. No German war vessel can get her or near her." Turner's personal experience affirmed this. On two previous occasions, while captain of a different ship, he had encountered what he believed were submarines and had successfully eluded them by ordering full speed ahead. He said nothing about these incidents to his audience. Now he offered a different sort of reassurance. Upon entering the war zone the next day, the ship would be securely in the care of the Royal Navy. He bade the audience good night and returned to the bridge. The talent show continued. A few passengers slept fully clothed in the dining room for fear of being trapped below decks in their cabins if an attack were to occur. One especially anxious traveler, a Greek carpet merchant, put on a life jacket and climbed into a lifeboat to spend the night. Another passenger, a New York businessman named Isaac Lehman, took a certain comfort from the revolver that he carried with him always, and that would, all too soon, bring him a measure of fame and infamy. With all but a few lights extinguished and all shades pulled and curtains drawn, the great liner slid forward through the sea, at times in fog, at times under a lacework of stars. But even in darkness, in moonlight and mist, the ship stood out. At 1 o'clock in the morning, Friday, May 7th, the officers of a New York-bound vessel spotted the Lusitania and recognized it immediately as it passed some 2 miles off. "You could see the shape of the four funnels," said the captain, Thomas M. Taylor. "She was the only ship with four funnels." Unmistakable and invulnerable, a floating village in steel, the Lusitania glided by in the night, as a giant black shadow cast upon the sea. Part 1. Bloody Monkeys. Lusitania, the old sailor man. The smoke from ships and the exhalations of the river left a haze that blurred the world and made the big liner seem even bigger, less the product of human endeavor than an escarpment rising from a plane. The hull was black. Seagulls flew past in slashes of white. Pretty, no. Not yet the objects of horror they would become later, for the man standing on the ship's bridge, 7 stories above the wharf. The liner was edged bow-first into a slip at Pier 54 on the Hudson, off the western end of 14th Street in Manhattan, one of a row of 4 piers operated by the Cunard Steamship Company of Liverpool, England. From the 2 catwalks that jutted outward from the ship's bridge, its wings, the captain could get a good look along the full length of the hull, and it was here that he would stand on Saturday, May 1st, 1915, a few days hence, when the ship was to set off on yet another voyage across the Atlantic. Despite the war in Europe, by now in its 10th month, longer than anyone had expected it to last, the ship was booked to capacity, set to carry nearly 2,000 people, or souls, of whom 1,265 were passengers, including an unexpectedly large number of children and babies. This was, according to the New York Times, the greatest number of Europe-bound travelers on a single vessel since the year began. When fully loaded with crew, passengers, luggage, stores, and cargo, the ship weighed, or displaced, over 44,000 tons and could sustain a top speed of more than 25 knots, about 30 miles an hour. With many passenger ships withdrawn from service or converted to military use, this made the Lusitania the fastest civilian vessel afloat. Only destroyers and Britain's latest oil-fueled Queen Elizabeth-class battleships could move faster. That a ship of such size could achieve so great a speed was considered one of the miracles of the modern age. During an early trial voyage, a circumnavigation of Ireland in July 1907, a passenger from Rhode Island sought to capture the larger meaning of the ship and its place in the new century. The Lusitania, he told the Cunard Daily Bulletin, published aboard ship, is in itself a perfect epitome of all that man knows or has discovered or invented up to this moment of time. The paper reported that the passengers had taken a vote of censure against Cunard for 2 flagrant omissions from the ship. She has neither a grouse moor nor a deer forest aboard. One passenger noted that if the need for a new Noah's Ark ever arose, he would skip the bit about building the boat and just charter the Lusitania. For I calculate that there is room on her for 2 of every animal extant and more. The bulletin devoted the last paragraph to waggling Cunard's fingers at Germany, claiming that the ship had just received news by wireless that Kaiser Wilhelm himself had sent a telegram to the ship's builders. Please deliver me without delay 12 Baker's measure, Lusitania's. From the first, the ship became an object of national pride and affection. In keeping with Cunard's custom of naming its ships for ancient lands, the company had selected Lusitania after a Roman province on the Iberian Peninsula that occupied roughly the same ground as modern-day Portugal. The inhabitants were warlike, and the Romans conquered them with great difficulty, said a memorandum in Cunard's files on the naming of the ship. They lived generally upon plunder and were rude and unpolished in their manners. In popular usage, the name was foreshortened to Lucy. There was nothing rude or unpolished about the ship itself. As the Lusitania departed Liverpool on its first transatlantic run in 1907, some 100,000 spectators gathered at various points along the Mersey River to watch, many singing Rule Britannia and waving handkerchiefs. Passenger C.R. Minnett, in a letter he wrote aboard ship, told his wife how he had climbed to the highest deck and stood near one of the ship's 4 towering funnels to best capture the moment. You do not get any idea of her size till you get right on top, and then it is like being on Lincoln Cathedral, Minnett wrote. I went over parts of the first class, and it is really impossible to describe. It is so beautiful. The ship's beauty belied its complexity. From the start, it needed a lot of attention. In its first winter, woodwork in the first-class writing room and dining saloon and in various passageways began to shrink and had to be rebuilt. Excess vibration forced Cunard to pull the ship from service so that extra bracing could be installed. Something was always breaking or malfunctioning. A baking oven exploded, injuring a crew member. Boilers needed to be scaled and cleaned. During crossings in winter, pipes froze and ruptured. The ship's light bulbs failed at an alarming rate. This was no small problem. The Lusitania had 6,000 lamps. The ship endured. It was fast, comfortable, and beloved, and as of the end of April 1915, had completed 201 crossings of the Atlantic. To ready the ship for its Saturday, May 1st departure, much had to be done with speed and efficiency, and at this, Captain William Thomas Turner excelled. Within the Cunard Empire, there were none better than he at handling large ships. While serving a rotation as captain of Cunard's Aquitania, Turner had achieved a measure of fame during an arrival in New York by fitting the ship into its slip and snugging it to its wharf in just 19 minutes. He held the record for a round voyage, meaning round trip, which he achieved in December 1910, when, as captain of the Lusitania's twin, the Mauritania, he piloted the ship to New York and back in just 14 days. Cunard rewarded him with a silver salver. He found it very gratifying, but also surprising. "I did not expect to receive any such recognition of my part in the matter," he wrote in a thank you letter. "We all on board simply tried to do our duty as under any ordinary circumstances." Complex, detailed, and messy, this process of readying the Lusitania involved a degree of physical labor that was masked by the ship's outward grace. Anyone looking up from the dock saw only beauty on a monumental scale, while on the far side of the ship men turned black with dust as they shoveled coal, 5,690 tons in all, into the ship through openings in the hull called side pockets. The ship burned coal at all times. Even when docked, it consumed 140 tons a day to keep furnaces hot and boilers primed, and to provide electricity from the ship's dynamo to power lights, elevators, and, very important, the Marconi transmitter, whose antenna stretched between its two masts. When the Lusitania was underway, its appetite for coal was enormous. Its 300 stokers, trimmers, and firemen, working 100 per shift, would shovel 1,000 tons of coal a day into its 192 furnaces to heat its 25 boilers and generate enough superheated steam to spin the immense turbines of its engines. The men were called the Black Gang, a reference not to their race, but to the coal dust that coated their bodies. The boilers occupied the bottom deck of the ship and were gigantic, like wheelless locomotives, each 22 feet long and 18 feet in diameter. They needed close attention at all times, for when fully pressurized, each stored enough explosive energy to tear a small ship in half. 50 years earlier, exploding boilers had caused America's worst ever maritime disaster— the destruction of the Mississippi River steamboat Sultana at a cost of 1,800 lives. No matter what measures the crew took, coal dust migrated everywhere, under stateroom doors, through keyholes, and up companionways, compelling stewards to go through the ship with dust cloths to clean rails, door handles, tabletops, deck chairs, plates, pans, and any other surface likely to collect falling soot. The dust posed its own hazard. In certain concentrations, it was highly explosive and raised the possibility of a cataclysm within the ship's hull. Cunard barred crew members from bringing their own matches on board and provided them instead with safety matches, which ignited only when scraped against a chemically treated surface on the outside of the box. Anyone caught bringing his own matches aboard was to be reported to Captain Turner. The ship was built to be fast. It was conceived out of hubris and anxiety at a time, 1903, when Britain feared it was losing the race for dominance of the passenger ship industry. In America, J.P. Morgan was buying up shipping lines in hopes of creating a monopoly. In Europe, Germany had succeeded in building the world's fastest ocean liners and thereby winning the Blue Riband, awarded to the liner that crossed the Atlantic in the shortest time. By 1903, German ships had held the Riband for 6 years, to the sustained mortification of Britain. With the Empire's honor and Cunard's future both at stake, the British government and the company agreed to a unique deal. The Admiralty would lend Cunard up to £2.4 million, or nearly $2 billion in today's dollars, at an interest rate of only 2.75%, to build two gigantic liners, the Lusitania and Mauritania. In return, however, Cunard had to make certain concessions. First and foremost, the Admiralty required that the Lusitania be able to maintain an average speed across the Atlantic of at least 24.5 knots. In early trials, it topped 26 knots. There were other, more problematic conditions. The Admiralty also required that the two ships be built so that in the event of war they could be readily equipped with naval artillery and brought into service as armed auxiliary cruisers. The Admiralty went so far as to direct the Lusitania's builders to install mounts, or holding down rings, in its decks, capable of accepting a dozen large guns. Moreover, the Lusitania's hull was to be designed to battleship specifications, which required the use of longitudinal coal bunkers, essentially tunnels along both sides of the hull to store the ship's coal and speed its distribution among the boiler rooms. At the time, when naval warfare took place at or above the waterline, this was considered smart warship design. To naval shipbuilders, coal was a form of armor, and longitudinal bunkers were thought to provide an additional level of protection. A naval engineering journal in 1907 stated that the coal in these bunkers would limit how far enemy shells could penetrate the hull, and thus would counteract, as far as possible, the effect of the enemy's fire at the waterline. When the war began, the Admiralty, exercising rights granted by its deal with Cunard, took possession of the Lusitania, but soon determined the ship would not be effective as an armed cruiser because the rate at which it consumed coal made it too expensive to operate under battle conditions. The Admiralty retained control of the Mauritania for conversion to a troop ship, a role for which its size and speed were well suited, but restored the Lusitania to Cunard for commercial service. The guns were never installed, and only the most astute passenger would have noticed the mounting rings embedded in the decking. The Lusitania remained a passenger liner, but with the hull of a battleship. A stickler for detail and discipline, Captain Turner called himself an old-fashioned sailorman. He had been born in 1856, in the age of sail and empire. His father had been a sea captain, but had hoped his son would choose a different path and enter the church. Turner refused to become a devil dodger, his term, and at the age of 8 somehow managed to win his parents' permission to go to sea. He wanted adventure, and found it in abundance. He first served as a cabin boy on a sailing ship, the Grasmere, which ran aground off Northern Ireland on a clear moonlit night. Turner swam for shore. All the other crew and all passengers aboard were rescued, though one infant died of bronchitis. "Had it been stormy," one passenger wrote, "I believe not a soul could have been saved." Turner moved from ship to ship, and at one point sailed under his father's command aboard a square rigger. I was the quickest man aloft in a sailing ship, Turner said. His adventures continued. While he was second mate of a clipper ship, the Thunderbolt, a wave knocked him into the sea. He had been fishing at the time. A fellow crewman saw him fall and threw him a life buoy, but he floated for over an hour among circling sharks before the ship could fight its way back to his position. He joined Cunard on October 4th, 1877, at a salary of £5 per month, and 2 weeks later sailed as third officer of the Cherbourg, his first steamship. He again proved himself a sailor of more than usual bravery and agility. One day, in heavy fog, as the Cherbourg was leaving Liverpool, the ship struck a small bark, which began to sink. Four crew and a harbor pilot drowned. The Cherbourg dispatched a rescue party, which included Turner, who himself pulled a crewman and a boy from the rigging. Turner served as third officer on two other Cunard ships, but resigned on June 28, 1880, after learning that the company never promoted a man to captain unless he'd been master of a ship before joining the company. Turner built his credentials, earned his master's certificate, and became captain of a clipper ship, and along the way found yet another opportunity to demonstrate his courage. In February 1883, a boy of 14 fell from a dock into Liverpool Harbor, into water so cold it could kill a man in minutes. Turner was a strong swimmer. At a time when most sailors still held the belief that there was no point in knowing how to swim, since it would only prolong your suffering, Turner leapt in and rescued the boy. The Liverpool Shipwreck and Humane Society gave him a silver medal for heroism. That same year, he rejoined Cunard and married a cousin, Alice Hitching. They had two sons, the first, Percy, in 1885, and Norman 8 years later. Even now, as a certified ship's master, Turner's advance within Cunard took time. The delay, according to his best and longtime friend George Ball, caused him great frustration. But, Ball added, never at any time did he relax in devotion to duty, nor waver in the loyalty he always bore to his ship and his captain. Over the next two decades, Turner worked his way upward from third officer to chief officer, through 18 different postings, until on March 19, 1903, Cunard at last awarded him his own command. He became master of a small steamship, the Aleppo, which served Mediterranean ports. His home life did not fare as well. His wife left him, took the boys, and moved to Australia. Turner's sisters hired a young woman, Mabel Every, to care for him. Miss Every and Turner lived near each other, in a suburb of Liverpool called Great Crosby. At first she served as a housekeeper, but over time she became more of a companion. She saw a side of Turner that his officers and crew did not. He liked smoking his pipe and telling stories. He loved dogs and cats and had a fascination with bees. He liked to laugh. On the ships, he was a very strict disciplinarian, Miss Every wrote, but at home, he was a very kind, jolly man, and fond of children and animals. Despite the sorrow that shaded his personal life, his career gained momentum. After 2 years as master of the Aleppo, he moved on to command the Carpathia, the ship that later, in April 1912, under a different captain, would become famous for rescuing survivors of the Titanic. Next came the Ivernia, the Caronia, and the Umbria. His advance was all the more remarkable given that he lacked the charm and polish that Cunard expected its commanders to display. A Cunard captain was supposed to be much more than a mere navigator. Resplendent in his uniform and cap, he was expected to exude assurance, competence, and gravitas. But a captain also served a role less easy to define. He was three parts mariner, one part club director. He was to be a willing guide for first-class passengers wishing to learn more about the mysteries of the ship. He was to preside over dinners with prominent passengers. He was to walk the ship and engage passengers in conversation about the weather, their reasons for crossing the Atlantic, the books they were reading. Turner would sooner bathe in bilge. According to Mabel Every, he described passengers as a load of bloody monkeys who were constantly chattering. He preferred dining in his quarters to holding court at the captain's table in the first-class dining room. He spoke little, and did so with a parsimony that could be maddening. He also tended to be blunt. On one voyage, while in command of the Carpathia, he ran afoul of two priests, who felt moved to write to Cunard, complaining of certain remarks that Turner had made when they asked permission to hold a Roman Catholic service for third-class passengers. Exactly what Turner said cannot be known, but his remarks were sufficient to cause Cunard to demand a formal report and to make the incident a subject of deliberation at a meeting of the company's board of directors. At the start of another voyage, while he was in charge of the Mauritania, a woman traveling in first class told Turner that she wanted to be on the bridge as the ship moved along the Mersey River out to sea. Turner explained that this would be impossible, for Cunard rules expressly prohibited anyone other than necessary officers and crew from being on the bridge in narrow waters. She asked, what would he do if a lady happened to insist? Turner replied, "Madam, do you think that would be a lady?" Turner's social burden was eased in 1913 when Cunard, acknowledging the complexity of running the Lusitania and the Mauritania, created a new officer's position for both, that of staff captain, second in command of the ship. Not only did this allow Turner to concentrate on navigation, it largely eliminated his obligation to be charming. The Lusitania's staff captain as of May 1915 was James Jock Anderson, whom Turner described as more clubbable. The crew respected Turner and, for the most part, liked him. I think I speak for all the crew if I say we all had the utmost confidence in Captain Turner, said one of the ship's waiters. He was a good and conscientious skipper. But one officer, Albert Arthur Bestick, observed that Turner was popular only up to a point. Bestick noted that Turner still seemed to have one foot on the deck of a sailing ship, as became evident at odd moments. One evening, while Bestick and other crewmen were off duty and playing bridge, the ship's quartermaster appeared at the door carrying a knot called a Turk's head. Complex to begin with, this was a four-stranded variant, the most complicated of all. "Captain's compliments," the quartermaster said, "and he says he wants another of these made." The bridge game stopped, Bestick recalled, and we spent the rest of the second dog, the watch from 6 to 8 p.m., trying to remember how it was made. This was not easy. The knot was typically used for decoration, and none of the men had tied one in a long while. Wrote Bestick, it was Turner's idea of humor. Under Turner, the Lusitania broke all records for speed, to the dismay of Germany. In a 1909 voyage from Liverpool to New York, the ship covered the distance from Daunt Rock off Ireland to New York's Ambrose Channel in 4 days, 11 hours, and 42 minutes, at an average speed of 25.85 knots. Until then, that kind of speed had seemed an impossibility. As the ship passed the Nantucket lightship, it was clocked at 26 knots. Turner attributed the speed to new propellers installed the preceding July, and to the prowess of his engineers and firemen. He told a reporter the ship would have made it even faster if not for foul weather and a head-on sea at the beginning of the voyage and a gale that arose at the end. The reporter noted that Turner looked bronzed from the sun. By May 1915, Turner was the most seasoned captain at Cunard, the commodore of the line. He had confronted all manner of shipboard crises, including mechanical mishaps, fires, cracked furnaces, open sea rescues, and extreme weather of all kinds. He was said to be fearless. One seaman aboard the Lusitania, Thomas Mahoney, called him one of the bravest captains I sailed under. It was Turner who experienced what may have been the most frightening threat to the Lusitania, this during a voyage to New York in January 1910, when he encountered a phenomenon he had never previously met in his half-century at sea. Soon after leaving Liverpool, the ship entered a gale with a powerful headwind and tall seas that required Turner to reduce speed to 14 knots. By itself, the weather posed no particular challenge. He had seen worse, and the ship handled the heavy seas with grace. And so, on Monday evening, January 11th, at 6 o'clock, soon after leaving the coast of Ireland behind, Turner went down one deck to his quarters to have dinner. He left his chief officer in charge. "The wave," Turner said, "came as a surprise." It was not just any wave, but an accumulative wave, known in later times as a rogue, formed when waves pile one upon another to form a single palisade of water. The Lusitania had just climbed a lesser wave and was descending into the trough beyond it when the sea ahead rose in a wall so high it blocked the helmsman's view of the horizon. The ship plunged through it. Water came to the top of the wheelhouse, 80 feet above the waterline. The wave struck the front of the bridge like a giant hammer and bent steel plates inward. Wood shutters splintered. A large spear of broken teak pierced a hardwood cabinet to a depth of 2 inches. Water filled the bridge and wheelhouse and tore the wheel loose, along with the helmsman. The ship began to fall off, so that its bow was no longer perpendicular to the oncoming waves, a dangerous condition in rough weather. The lights of the bridge and on the masthead above short-circuited and went out. The officers and helmsmen struggled to their feet, initially in waist-high water. They reattached the wheel and corrected the ship's heading. The wave's impact had broken doors, bent internal bulkheads, and shattered 2 lifeboats. By sheerest luck, no one was seriously injured. Turner rushed to the bridge and found water and chaos, but once he assured himself that the ship had endured the assault without catastrophic damage and that no passengers had been hurt, he simply added it to his long list of experiences at sea. Fog was one of the few phenomena that worried him. There was no way to predict its occurrence, and once in fog, one had no way to know whether another vessel was 30 miles ahead or 30 yards. The Cunard Manual, rules to be observed in the company's service, required that when encountering fog, a captain had to post extra lookouts, reduce speed, and turn on his ship's foghorn. The rest of it was luck and careful navigation. A captain had to know his position at all times as precisely as possible, because fog could arise quickly. One instant there'd be clear sky, the next, obliteration. The dangers of fog had become grotesquely evident 1 year earlier, also in May, when the Empress of Ireland of the Canadian Pacific Line was struck by a collier, a coal-carrying freighter, in a fog bank in the St. Lawrence River. The Empress sank in 14 minutes with the loss of 1,012 lives. Turner knew the importance of precise navigation and was considered to be especially good at it, careful to the extreme, especially in the narrow waters close to a port. Come Saturday morning, May 1st, Turner would make a detailed inspection of the ship, accompanied by his purser and chief steward. All preparations for the voyage had to be completed by then. Rooms cleaned, beds made, all stores, gin, scotch, cigars, peas, mutton, beef, ham, loaded aboard, all cargo in place, and the ship's supply of drinking water tested for freshness and clarity. Special attention was always to be paid to lavatories and bilges, and to maintaining proper levels of ventilation, lest the liners start to stink. The goal, in official Cunard parlance, was to keep the ship sweet. Everything had to be done in such a manner that none of the passengers, whether in first class or third, would be aware of the nature and extent of the week's travail. The needs of passengers were paramount, as the Cunard manual made clear. The utmost courtesy and attention are at all times to be shown to passengers whilst they are on board the company's ships, and it is the special duty of the captain to see that this regulation is observed by the officers and others serving under him. On one previous voyage, this duty included allowing two big game hunters, Mr. and Mrs. D. Saunderson of County Cavan, Ireland, to bring 2 4-month-old lion cubs aboard, which they had captured in British East Africa and planned to give to the Bronx Zoo. The couple's 2-year-old daughter Lydia played with the cubs on deck, much to the amusement of the other passengers, according to the New York Times. Mrs. Saunderson attracted a good deal of attention herself. She had killed an elephant. "No, I was not afraid," she told the Times. "I think I never am." Complaints had to be taken seriously, and there were always complaints. Passengers grumbled that food from the kitchen grill came to their tables cold. This issue was at least partly resolved by changing the route waiters had to walk. The typewriters in the typing room were too noisy and annoyed the occupants of adjacent staterooms. The hours for typing were shortened. Ventilation in some rooms was less than ideal, a stubborn flaw that drove passengers to open their portholes. There was a problem, too, with the upper-level dining room in first class. Its windows opened onto a promenade used by third-class passengers, who had an annoying habit of peering in through the windows at the posh diners within. And there were always those passengers who came aboard bearing moral grudges against the modern age. A second-class passenger on a 1910 voyage complained that the ship's decks should not be made a marketplace for the sale of Irish shawls, etc., and also that card-playing for money goes on incessantly in the smoking rooms on board the company's steamers. Cunard's foremost priority, however, was to protect its passengers from harm. The company had a remarkable safety record, not a single passenger death from sinking, collision, ice, weather, fire, or any other circumstance where blame could be laid upon captain or company, though, of course, deaths from natural causes occurred with regularity, especially among elderly passengers. The ship carried the latest in safety equipment. Owing to the epidemic of boat fever that swept the shipping industry after the Titanic disaster, the Lusitania had more than enough lifeboats for passengers and crew. The ship also had been recently equipped with the latest in life jackets, these made by the Body Life-Saving Appliances Company. Unlike the older vests, made of cloth-covered panels of cork, these resembled actual jackets. Said one passenger, "When you have it on, you look and feel like a padded football player, especially around the shoulders." The new body jackets were placed in the first and second-class staterooms. Third-class passengers and crew were to use the older kind. No safety issue escaped the notice of Cunard's board. On one crossing, as the Lusitania moved through heavy seas, crewmen discovered that a section of third class was full of water. The culprit was a single open porthole. The incident underscored the dangers posed by portholes in rough weather. The board voted to reprimand the stewards responsible for that section of the ship. For all the respect afforded Turner by Cunard and by the officers and crew who served under him, his own record was far from impeccable. In July 1905, 4 months after he took command of the Ivernia, the ship collided with another, the Carlingford Lock. An investigation by Cunard found Turner to be at fault for going too fast in fog. The company's directors resolved, according to board minutes, that he was to be severely reprimanded. 3 years later, a ship under his command, the Caronia, touched ground in the Ambrose Channel in New York and earned him another reprimand. The Caronia should not have left the dock at such a state of tide. The winter of 1914-15 was particularly hard on Turner. One of his ships, the newly launched Transylvania, caught a gust of wind while undocking in Liverpool and bumped against a White Star liner, causing minor damage. In a second incident that winter, the ship collided with another large liner, the Teutonic, and in a third, got bumped by a tugboat. But these things happened to all captains. Cunard's confidence in Turner was made clear by the fact that the company consistently put him in charge of its newest and biggest liners and made him master of the Lusitania for 3 different cycles. The war had made the matter of passenger safety all the more pressing. For Turner's immediate predecessor, Captain Daniel Dow, it had become too great a burden. On a March voyage to Liverpool, Dow had guided the Lusitania through waters in which 2 freighters had just been sunk. Afterward, he told his superiors at Cunard that he could no longer accept the responsibility of commanding a passenger ship under such conditions, especially if the ship carried munitions intended for Britain's military. The practice of transporting such cargo had become common and made any ship that carried it a legitimate target for attack. Cowardice had nothing to do with Dow's decision. What troubled him was not the danger to himself, but rather having to worry about the lives of 2,000 civilian passengers and crew. His nerves could not take it. Cunard decided he was tired and really ill, and relieved him of command. Washington, the Lonely Place. The train carrying the body of Ellen Axon Wilson pulled into the station at Rome, Georgia, at 2:30 in the afternoon, Tuesday, August 11th, 1914, under gunmetal skies, amid the peal of bells. The casket was placed in a hearse, and soon the cortege began making its way through town to the church in which the funeral service would take place, the First Presbyterian, where Mrs. Wilson's father had been a pastor. The streets were thronged with men and women come to pay their last respects to her and to show support for her husband, President Woodrow Wilson. They'd been married 29 years. Family members carried the casket into the church as the organist played Chopin's funeral march, that dour, trudging staple of death scenes everywhere. The service was brief. The chorus sang 2 hymns that had been her favorites. Next, the procession made its way up to the cemetery on Myrtle Hill, and the rain began. The hearse rolled past girls in white holding boughs of myrtle. Behind the girls stood townspeople and visitors, their hats off despite the rain. An awning had been erected over the gravesite to shelter Wilson and the friends and family who made up the funeral party. The rain became heavy and thudded against the cloth. Onlookers saw the president tremble as he wept. Those near at hand saw tears on his cheeks. Afterward, the mourners moved back to their cars, and the spectators, 1,000 of them, dispersed. Wilson stood alone beside the grave, neither speaking nor moving, until the coffin was fully covered. With the death of his wife, Wilson entered a new province of solitude, and the burden of leadership bore on him as never before. His wife had died on Thursday, August 6th, of a kidney illness then known as Bright's disease, 2 days after Britain entered the new war in Europe and just 1.5 years into his first term. In losing her, he lost not merely his main source of companionship, but also his primary advisor, whose observations he had found so useful in helping shape his own thinking. The White House became for him a lonely place, haunted not by the ghost of Lincoln, as some White House servants believed, but by memories of Ellen. For a time his grief seemed incapacitating. His physician and frequent golf companion, Dr. Cary Grayson, grew concerned. "For several days he has not been well," Grayson wrote on August 25, 1914, in a letter to a friend, Edith Bowling Galt. "I persuaded him yesterday to remain in bed during the forenoon. When I went to see him, tears were streaming down his face. It was a heartbreaking scene, a sadder picture no one could imagine. A great man with his heart torn out." Later that August, Wilson managed to get away to a country home in Cornish, New Hampshire, called Harlequin House, a large Georgian residence overlooking the Connecticut River on which he held a two-summer lease. Wilson's friend, Colonel Edward House, came to join him and was struck by the depth of his sorrow. At one point, as they talked about Ellen, the president, his eyes welling, told House that he felt like a machine that had run down, and there was nothing in him worthwhile. The president, House wrote in his diary, looked forward to the next 2.5 years with dread. He did not see how he could go through with it. There were crises on all fronts. The United States was still in the grip of a recession, now in its second year. The South in particular suffered. Cotton, its main product, had been transported mainly on foreign vessels, but the war had brought an acute shortage of ships, whose owners, fearing submarine attack, kept them in port. The belligerents, meanwhile, commandeered their own merchant ships for military use. Now millions of bales of cotton piled up on southern wharves. There was labor trouble as well. The United Mine Workers of America were on strike in Colorado. The preceding April, the state had sent a force of National Guard troops to break the strike, resulting in a massacre at Ludlow, Colorado, that left 2 dozen men, women, and children dead. Meanwhile, south of the border, violence and unrest continued to plague Mexico. Wilson's great fear, however, was that America might somehow find itself drawn into the war in Europe. That the war had begun at all was a dark amazement, for it had seemed to come from nowhere. At the start of that beautiful summer of 1914, one of the sunniest Europe would ever see, there had been no sign of war, and no obvious wish for it. On June 27th, the day before Europe began its slide into chaos, newspaper readers in America found only the blandest of news. The lead story on the front page of the New York Times was about Columbia University at last winning the intercollegiate rowing regatta after 19 years of failure. A Grape Nuts ad dealt with warfare, but of the schoolyard variety, extolling the cereal's value in helping children prevail in fistfights. "Husky bodies and stout nerves depend, more often than we think, on the food eaten." And the Times Society page named dozens of New York socialites, including a Guggenheim and a Wanamaker, who were scheduled to sail for Europe that day on the Minneapolis, the Caledonia, the Zealand, and 2 German-owned ships, the Prince Friedrich Wilhelm and the gigantic Imperator, 24 feet longer than the Titanic. In Europe, kings and high officials set off for their country homes. Kaiser Wilhelm would soon board his yacht, the Hohenzollern, to begin a cruise of the fjords of Norway. The President of France, Raymond Poincaré, and his foreign minister, departed by ship for a state visit to Tsar Nicholas II of Russia, who had moved to his summer palace. Winston Churchill, 40 years old and already Britain's top naval official, First Lord of the Admiralty, went to the beach, a home in Cromer on the North Sea, 100 miles north of London, where he joined his wife Clementine and his children. In England, the lay public was transfixed, not by any prospect of war, but by Sir Ernest Shackleton's planned expedition to the Antarctic in the square rigger Endurance, set to depart August 8th from Plymouth on Britain's southeast coast. In Paris, the big fascination was the trial of Henriette Caillaux, wife of former Prime Minister Joseph Caillaux, arrested for killing the editor of the Paris newspaper Le Figaro after the newspaper had published an intimate letter that the Prime Minister had written to her before their marriage, when they were having an adulterous affair. Enraged, Mrs. Caillot bought a gun, practiced with it at the gunsmith's shop, then went to the editor's office and fired 6 times. In her testimony, offering an unintended metaphor for what was soon to befall Europe, she said, "These pistols are terrible things. They go off by themselves." She was acquitted after persuading the court that the murder was a crime of passion. Far from a clamor for war, there existed a widespread, if naive, belief that war of the kind that had convulsed Europe in past centuries had become obsolete, that the economies of nations were so closely connected with one another that even if a war were to begin, it would end quickly. Capital flowed across borders. Belgium had the 6th largest economy in the world, not because of manufactures, but because of the money coursing through its banks. Enhanced communications, telephone, telegraph, cable, and most recently wireless, further entwined nations, as did the increasing capacity and speed of steamships and the expansion of railroads. Tourism grew as well. No longer just for the rich, it became a passion of the middle class. Populations increased. Markets expanded. In the United States, despite recession, the Ford Motor Company announced plans to double the size of its manufacturing plant. But old tensions and enmities persisted. Britain's King George V loathed his cousin Kaiser Wilhelm II, Germany's supreme ruler, and Wilhelm in turn envied Britain's expansive collection of colonies and its command of the seas, so much so that in 1900, Germany began a campaign to build warships in enough quantity and of large enough scale to take on the British Navy. This in turn drove Britain to begin an extensive modernization of its own navy, for which it created a new class of warship, the Dreadnought, which carried guns of a size and power never before deployed at sea. Armies swelled in size as well. To keep pace with each other, France and Germany introduced conscription. Nationalist fervor was on the rise. Austria-Hungary and Serbia shared a simmering mutual resentment. The Serbs nurtured pan-Slavic ambitions that threatened the skein of territories and ethnicities that made up the Austro-Hungarian Empire, typically referred to simply as Austria. These included such restive lands as Herzegovina, Bosnia, and Croatia. As one historian put it, Europe had too many frontiers, too many and too well-remembered histories, too many soldiers for safety. And secretly, nations began planning for how to use these soldiers should the need arise. As early as 1912, Britain's Committee of Imperial Defense had planned that in the event of war with Germany, the first act would be to cut Germany's transoceanic telegraph cables. In Germany, meanwhile, generals tinkered with a detailed plan crafted by Field Marshal Alfred von Schlieffen, the centerpiece of which was a vast maneuver that would bring German forces through neutral Belgium and down into France, thus skirting defenses arrayed along the French frontier. That Britain might object, indeed would be compelled to intervene as a co-guarantor of Belgian neutrality, seemed not to weigh heavily on anyone's mind. Schlieffen calculated that the war in France would be over in 42 days, after which German forces would reverse course and march toward Russia. What he failed to take into account was what would happen if German forces did not prevail in the time allotted, and if Britain did join the fray. The war began with the geopolitical equivalent of a brush fire. In late June, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, Inspector General of the Austro-Hungarian Army, traveled to Bosnia, which Austria had annexed in 1908. While driving through Sarajevo, He was shot dead by an assassin sponsored by the Black Hand, a group devoted to unifying Serbia and Bosnia. On July 28th, Austria stunned the world by declaring war on Serbia. "It's incredible." "Incredible," Wilson said during lunch with